John chapter 4. One of the things you notice when you begin to look at the Gospels, and a lot of people look at them and think that that all four Gospels are roughly the same, that they pretty well tell the same story, and in many cases they do. There are a lot of similarities between the four Gospels, a lot of the stories that are shared in all four. Some stories are only in certain Gospels, but you may have heard the phrase the Synoptic Gospels. Matthew, Mark, and Luke are what we call the Synoptic Gospels, and they are, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, when you put them together, are more of a timeline, more of a biography of the life of Christ, more of a, again, you can put them together and get a pretty good, you know, you may have to go between them, but between the three, you can put together roughly the timeline of the earthly life of Christ. The Gospel of John is different in that John, as, don't take this wrong, it's not that Matthew and Mark and Luke don't have theology in them, certainly they do. John is more of a theology of Christ. John actually, about two-thirds of the book of John actually revolves around the final week of Christ's life. And so he doesn't give us a great deal of, again, didn't even include the Christmas story. And so John doesn't give us a great deal of the history of the lifeline of Christ. In fact, you'll notice if you think about it, what we've looked at the last few weeks in John have been stories of interactions with individuals. He had a conversation with Nicodemus. He had a interaction with people at the wedding. He had an interaction with the woman at the well. And so John, thus far, has been really, after an introduction, has been a series of meetings. And again, they're interesting meetings because, again, each one of them, you've got such a broad spectrum of people. It's really a cool story when you look at it and think about, well, he starts off with Nicodemus, a rich religious person. He goes and we have a Samaritan woman. We're going to talk about a nobleman, a rich man's son. And so there's all kinds of people. And I think one of the lessons that John brings across to us is the gospel of Jesus Christ for us all. He really writes so that we can know in whom we have believed. John writes to introduce the salvation of Jesus Christ. And so this morning we pick up after the story of the woman at the well. And the Bible tells us that he, if you look there, beginning in chapter 4, that when we look there, that he spent 2 days with the woman, and when that time was done, beginning in verse 43, it says, after the 2 days, it doesn't seem like it, but it when you read the story, but it tells us that he was there 2 days, and he goes to Galilee. There's this brief section that where he talks about a prophet having no honor in his own country, and so he goes to Galilee, and the Galileans, it says, receive him, they've heard about the things that he did at Jerusalem, and they are receptive. They are listening to the message. And in the middle of that is where we pick up today with the story, kind of an interruption, kind of someone steps in as Christ is speaking. he is interrupted, and they talk to him, and he has this story happen. So I'm going to ask you, if you will, it's a long story. We're going to go, rather than stand and read it all, because it's kind of a lengthy story, we'll just leave your Bibles open, and we'll go back to it throughout the story. But what we have happen here is it says that as he gets to Cana, and Cana is important. If you remember, Cana is where the original miracle, where the changing of the water to wine took place. And so Jesus goes back to Cana. And so his reputation, no doubt, there has preceded him. Others have, they've probably talked a good bit about the miracle at the wedding. And because of that, he tells us that a certain nobleman, and nobleman is a phrase, a word that I don't think I've ever heard anybody called a nobleman. But a nobleman basically means one of the king's guys. He was most likely one of Herod's trusted servants. He was an important, powerful man. And as Jesus is teaching, and again says he's being well received here, this man comes from Capernaum, about 20 miles away, and he comes to Jesus. He comes to him, and he tells him, "My son is dying, and I need you to come and heal my son. You need to come with me. Stop what you're doing and come with me." And Jesus refuses to go, and in fact tells him, it appears that he's addressing only the nobleman, but he's actually addressing the whole crowd. The southern word that is used here is y'all. He says, y'all don't believe unless you see signs. Y'all don't believe unless you see something miraculous happen. And then he tells the man, go home, your son is fine. And so the man goes home, and as he starts towards home, he meets some of his servants, and they meet him and they tell him, your son is well. Your son is fine now. And so we see this story, and as I look in this story, one of the things that I think we see revealed to us in this story is the development of a disciple. We see a man who starts out as a nobleman, a man who in all likelihood had little, if any, relationship or understanding of Christ at all, who had no appreciation for Christ and the things of Christ, no doubt. Again, I'm certain he had obviously heard of Christ. He had heard of him enough that he was intrigued enough, that he was tried everything. A nobleman, he was a wealthy man. He had tried everything. He had tried all the doctors. He had tried all the medicines. He had done everything he knew to do for his son, and yet his son is at the point of death. And he hears that Jesus is nearby, that again he's about 20, 22 miles away from Capernaum to Cana. And so he rushes out of the house and he goes to meet Christ. And again, not a follower of Christ, but one who has heard of Christ, who has heard of already heard of some of the things that that Christ has done. Certainly, because he's in Cana, he's probably heard of the water being turned to wine. And so he says, well, I've tried everything else. I don't know what else to do. And so I'm going to go ask this Jesus to come and heal my son. And by the time we're to the end of the story, we read that the man and his whole family have become followers of Jesus Christ. And so we go from a man who has head knowledge, who has an awareness of Jesus Christ, who has an awareness of the things of Christ and the teaching, the power, the authority, the miracles of Christ. He has a head knowledge. We go in a few short verses, in less than 24 hours, we go from a man who has this head knowledge to a man who his entire home becomes followers of Jesus Christ. What I want you to see with me this morning is the progression of faith, the development of a disciple. And what I want you to do this morning, as we look at this story, and I want to kind of share with you, and perhaps it can be broken down even greater or to more steps, but I just kind of want to show you here five things that five development steps, five pieces in the progression of the faith of this nobleman. And to ask you then a simple question, on that scale, on that path, where are you? Where are we? Where are we in our development as disciples, as followers of Jesus Christ? I'm going to suggest this morning that there are some that you are like the nobleman in the early parts of this story. You are still head knowledge. You still, obviously, you're here. You know of Christ. You've heard of Christ. You've heard of church. You know about Christ. You know about His miracles. You know about His teachings. A head knowledge. That's where this nobleman starts out. And then we see how, again, because of the events, in about a 24-hour period, this nobleman goes from simply knowing of Christ to becoming not only a follower of Christ, but becoming a follower who then brings his whole family to follow Christ. And I think that is the ultimate sign of discipleship. Over the last few weeks, as I've prepared and studied this passage, I've asked several different people from different backgrounds. I've asked preachers, I've asked other people. I said, tell me, what would you say is the ultimate sign of a disciple? What is the ultimate sign of being a disciple of Christ? If there's one thing that indicates, and it's kind of hard to ask that question, if there's one thing that indicates that a person has arrived at the pinnacle of being a follower, a disciple of Christ, what is it? And I was curious. I really was. I was a little curious as some of the answers I would get. But the unanimous response to that question in every person I asked, when I said, what is the ultimate sign? How do we know that we have become a genuine, complete follower of Jesus Christ? A disciple. How do we know? Without hesitation, everyone answered the question this way: when we bring someone else to Christ. That's the ultimate sign of a disciple. I want you to notice that happened to this man in 24 hours. He goes from a knowledge of Jesus Christ, a head knowledge, to becoming an ultimate follower of Jesus Christ. Notice the path, if you will. He begins with us in this passage with the story again that Christ is here. And he's going, and he's teaching there in Galilee. And this man, he comes 22 miles roughly to meet Jesus Christ. First step, the first step on the way of the development of a disciple, I believe, is a pursuing faith. A pursuing faith. This man, again, it's obvious that his understanding of Christ is limited. He comes to Christ and he says, "You come on, yeah, come with me. You got to go with me. Come home with me. Stop what you're doing and come with me." He obviously doesn't really understand who he's talking to. He doesn't understand that he's speaking to the one that can calm the winds and the waves with his voice. He doesn't understand that he's speaking to the one that can call the dead out of the tomb simply by speaking their name. He thinks that somehow that Jesus must come to Capernaum. He thinks that somehow Jesus has got to go. He's got to come to my house. He's got to come down there. He's got to do CPR. He's got to do mouth to mouth. He's got to to lay hands on him. He's got to come and make a personal house call. He really doesn't understand the authority, the power of Jesus Christ. He really doesn't understand what it means to have faith in Jesus Christ. And Christ reveals that when he says in this passage, he says to it, he says, y'all only believe if you actually can see something. Y'all only believe if you actually can see a miracle. You can see a wonder. And so what Christ is saying to not only this man, but to the crowd, you haven't got it yet. You haven't really understood what it means to follow me. You really haven't understood who I am. That I have the authority that from right here, and we see that in this story, it's going to reveal itself. We see that Christ has the ability. In a moment, he says to him, "Go your way. Your son's fine." He didn't need to go to Capernaum. He didn't need to go touch him. He didn't need to go see him. He didn't even, if you look at this, he doesn't even know the young man. He doesn't even have the young man's name. He just says, go. Your son is healed. That is, I believe, an indication to us, a sign to us of where many people are in their journey with Jesus Christ. Where they are in their walk of faith. They know about Christ. They know who Christ is. They're looking for something from Christ. They're looking for Him to do something, to say something, to go somewhere, to do something. They're looking for, as Jesus calls it here, signs and wonders. But they're still in that pursuing mode where they are, where they're interested. I shared with you before the young man spent some time with talking to and would try to talk to him about Christ, and he would tell me, well, I'm considering that. I'm thinking about that Jesus story. I believe that was the way he said it to me one time. I'm thinking about that Jesus story, but there's also some other ideas, and there's some other teachings about how the world came into being, and there's some other things that I'm considering as well. Unfortunately, I think that there are actually maybe even some people in the church today who are still kind of sitting on the fence. They're kind of in the pursuing mode. They know they're looking for something. They're searching. There's something in them. There's a place inside of them. There's a desire in them. They know that there's something. More out there, that there's something bigger than them, that there's something that there's a piece of them that is missing, that something is incomplete. And this nobleman in these opening minutes of his conversation with Christ reveals to us that he has that kind of pursuing faith. And it's quite possible this morning that as we gather here today, that there's some of you who are in that situation, who you are in that place where you're in a pursuing mode. You're interested in Christ. You're thinking about Christ. You've read some of the Bible, and some of it makes sense to you. You've read some of Scripture, And some of it's interesting to you. You're like this man. You've heard some of the stories. It interests you to hear stories about Jesus walking on water. It interests you to hear stories about Lazarus. And it interests you to hear some of the prophecy and end time events. And all these things, they're interesting to you. But you're still kind of in that pursuing, that search mode, trying to figure out exactly what do I believe, exactly what do I do, how do I respond, how do I react to what I know. Well, what do I do with what I know? Well, what do I do with the knowledge that I have? And I think there's a lot of folks who have, not just in church now, but have been in church sometimes even for a lengthy period of time. That they've been there for a while, and even though they've been in church for a while, that they're there, but they're still processing. I really don't know what I'm going to do with what I know. You know, I really don't know what I'm going to do with this Jesus. I really don't know what I'm going to do. They're pursuing, and they're still searching and looking for an answer. And I've got to believe this morning that there's enough people here, that there are some of you here that quite likely are in that boat, that you are in a position where you've been in church, where you've been around the things of God, and you're interested, but you've just never really decided, okay, this is what I'm going to do. This is how I'm going to react. This is how I'm going to respond. This man was interested enough to travel 22 miles, which for you and I, 22 miles, some of you may have traveled that far this morning to get to church. 22 miles in a Ford, well, maybe in a Ford, but 22 miles, is not that far. If somebody's pushing, but 22 miles on foot, that's a little bit of a journey. This man was that interested. He was pursuing Christ. But we see as he began to pursue Christ, here's what quickly happens when you pursue Christ. When you begin to learn about and you begin to hear about the things of Christ, what quickly happens is you get brought to a point where you decide, I've got to take it or leave it. I've got to take it or leave it. We saw this with Nicodemus a few chapters ago. Nicodemus, here it is. Here's the story. Follow me or not. You have to decide. We see that in the Gospels as Jesus calls His disciples, follow me. They have to make a choice. They have to make a decision. Will you follow me or not? And so quickly after becoming aware of the things of Christ, we come to a point where we're forced to make a decision, where we're forced to decide, am I going to follow Him or am I going to reject Him? And so that's what happens to this man. When as he comes to Jesus, he grabs him by the arm, basically, and says, you got to come with me. And the young man, the nobleman, is literally begging. He's literally pleading with God. When he comes to Christ, originally, he comes to him and he says, come down in verse 47, he says to him that my son is at the point of death. But then you notice in verse 49 that he says there, in verse 49, he says, before my child died. He moves real quick from saying, Lord, come before my child dies, to saying, my little boy. He's pleading with Jesus. He's practically on his knees. He's appealing to the compassion of Jesus Christ. He goes from, hey, my son is sick, to my baby is sick. You know the difference in that statement, don't you? You know, you ever heard anybody say, you know, my child is sick, my son is sick, my baby is sick. You hear that? You know, if you hear Pansy say, my baby's sick, you know that Pansy's babies are not babies anymore. They're adults. But if you hear Pansy say, Lynn is sick, or Penny is sick, you say, well, that's bad, I'll pray. If you hear Pansy say, my baby is sick, doesn't that immediately tell you we've elevated the sickness a notch? Doesn't that immediately tell you we've stepped it up a notch? We see that the first thing for this man, what was a pursuing faith. But notice what happens. A pursuing faith quickly turns in, to a persistent faith. He pleads with the man. He goes from simply being someone who has traveled from Capernaum to meet Jesus. He goes from someone who has traveled just to meet this guy he's heard about to a persistent faith. His faith, even though I'm not sure he realizes it, his faith is developing. He comes to a point where, notice again what he says. He's sold out. He's hitched his cart to Jesus. He's went from my little boy is sick to my baby is sick. And he said to him, basically, if you don't come, he dies. In other words, this man looks at Christ and says, you are my only hope. You are my only hope. You, without you, my child will die. My son has no hope without you. This man, in a matter of moments, you see his faith developing. You see his confidence in Christ developing. You see his relationship with Christ developing. He goes from a man who has no real knowledge of Christ that we know of to a man who, in a matter of moments, and you can read this story and tell, this didn't take long. You think about it for a moment. If your child is on his deathbed, and you have come to this point, do you spend a whole lot of time at the back of the line? I can only imagine that this man, he did some elbowing. He did some shoving. He probably ticked a few people off on the way to the front of the line. He was determined to get to Jesus Christ. He was going up there. He goes from a man who has a knowledge of Jesus Christ to a man who in a matter of moments realizes, you're my only hope. You're my only hope. The development of a disciple, I believe, takes that same path. When we come to the point where we realize and we hitch everything we have, everything we are, everything we hope to be, everything we're going to be to Jesus Christ. When we come to the place where we say, there is no other hope. When we come to the place where we say, like Thomas. People talk about Thomas and calling doubting Thomas. But when Thomas says to Christ, if we don't follow you, who would we follow? You know, where else would we go? You know, I can't remember who made the quote that said, those who in times of trouble fling away from Christ, where do you fling to? You know, who do you fling to? Who do you turn to? You know, if you don't turn to Christ, who do you turn to? And in a matter of moments, this man, his faith has developed to the point where he says, you know what? I don't have any hope. I don't have anywhere else to turn. I don't have anything else to count on. I don't have anybody else. I have brought, you know, as the old saying goes, all my eggs are in this basket. You know, Jesus, you're it. You know, if you turn me down, I've got to go home and look at my wife in the eye and tell her I failed. If you turn, this man was convinced in his mind, he was 100% convinced of this fact. If Jesus tells me no, I've got to go home and plan a funeral. That's how quickly this man's confidence, I don't know what transpired, but in that few moments of meeting Christ, in that few moments, he had heard about Christ. No doubt he had heard about the water being turned to wine, but in that few moments of shoving himself to the front of the line and eyeballing Jesus, looking at Christ, seeing the compassion in his eyes, seeing the look, whatever he saw, when this man saw Christ, he said, "This is my only hope." This morning, where are we on our progression? Where are we in our progression of faith? I'm afraid that Christ, instead of being our first and only hope, is oftentimes our last resort. You know how I see that, how I know that? I look at church attendance. And I see how many go about their life, and they go about doing the things they want to do. They go about doing whatever they choose. They go about making their own decisions. They go about living life however they want. And when finally, you know, the three wheels have fallen off and they're still clunking along, you know, sparks flying off, you know, but they're still clunking along. And when finally the fourth wheel falls off, they finally come in and say, "Will the church pray for me? Can the church, I want God to help me." This man realizes early on his only hope is in Jesus Christ. Where are we putting our faith? Where are we putting our confidence? Is Christ kind of like the fire extinguisher? Is he kind of like the life jacket? I don't know about you, but most every boat I've ever been on, well, every boat I've ever been on, I guess, has life jackets. But I've noticed something about them. Anybody notice anything? Somebody tell me something about life jackets on a boat. They're down underneath. They're in a compartment. Yeah, they're always, you know, they're always locked up. Maybe not locked up, but they're always in a compartment somewhere. Very seldom do you see somebody actually on a lake in a boat with a life jacket on. They're there, but God help us if the boat starts sinking, because we're going to have to find them. Yeah. Now let's think about that for a moment. What do most people, I don't know how many of you have been around boats in the lake, that kind of thing, but most people, if they take their young child or their grandchild out on the lake in a boat, what is the first thing they do? Put a life jacket on them. Does that seem odd? Certainly doesn't seem odd to put a life jacket on the kid. But doesn't it seem a little bit odd that for the rest of us, the life jackets are optional, are stored? If life jackets are really that important, a life-saving device, shouldn't they be, and listen, I'm guilty, you know, I have confidence in my swimming ability. I'm guilty. You know, I don't know that I've ever had a life jacket on in a boat. I know where they are, I think. You know, they may be rotten by now, but, you know. But doesn't it seem odd that, you know, that for everybody else we say, here, put on a life jacket, we really understand the value of it? But for me, I'll take my chances. And if I can't swim my way out, if I can't grab hold of a stump, if I can't grab hold of, you know, if I can't, you know, I'll grab hold of you and hang on to you and push you under something, then I'll get a life jacket. Folks, is that where a lot of us are with Jesus Christ? We're trying to band-aid our life. We're trying to patch our life. We're trying to put it together. We're trying to bandage our marriage. We're trying to bandage our finances. We're trying to patch up our relationship with our children. We're trying to put pieces together. When this man comes to the point where he realizes, my only hope is you, what will it take to bring us to that point of a persistent faith? Not only do we see then it goes to a persistent faith, but look what happens. Look at verse 50. Something happens to a persistent faith. Verse 50, Jesus says, go thy way, thy son liveth. And the man believed the word that Jesus said. Is that not one of the most unusual verses in Scripture? I don't know about in Scripture, but it's certainly unusual in Baptist life, isn't it? Anybody see what's unusual about that passage in Baptist life? He believed. Listen to what it says. It says, Jesus says to him, go your way. The son is healed. And the man believed what Jesus had spoken to him and went his way. He believed and obeyed. Does that remind you of an old hymn we sing? Trust and obey, for there's no other way. A persistent faith becomes a practiced faith. If our faith isn't being practiced, is it really faith? Is it really faith if we're not practicing it? If I say this morning, I have faith in this stool, but I'm not going to sit on it, is that really faith? If I say I have faith in my car to get me home, but I ask Archie to take me home, and do I really have faith in that car? Is that really faith? Faith that's not practiced is what? Faith without works is what? Dead. A faith that is not practiced is dead. Unfortunately, we've got to realize, again, that our faith takes developing. It has to grow. And a lot of us are stuck in these steps. Our faith is really not practiced. Again, it's kind of like a life jacket. I've got a lot of faith in a life jacket for someone else. I've got a lot of faith, you know, in that life jacket for a child. I've got a lot of faith in that bridge for you. You go ahead. I've talked to you before. The story about the guy pushing the wheelbarrow across the tightrope over Niagara Falls. The guy said, you know, he gets to the side. Said, do you believe I can do it again? He says, sure. He said, well, get in the wheelbarrow. You know, a faith that doesn't have works is dead. For this man to say in this passage, if this man says, Lord, you're my only hope. If you don't heal my son will die. And then you read in the next verse that Jesus said, go your way, your son lives. And the next verse you read said that man went by the doctor's office and got the doctor and said, come with me to check on my son. Is that faith? Now listen, don't misunderstand me. I'm not telling you don't trust or use doctors. That's not what I'm saying. And not at all. Obviously, I'm sitting here, you know, at the mercy of one. Yeah. I'm not telling you that we don't use doctors. I'm not that kind of preacher. Yeah. What I am saying is that if we have faith in God, we practice that faith. That faith is used in our life. It shows up in our life. We trust God. We put our confidence in Him when no one else can understand. As someone has said, faith is stepping out where there's nothing, believing there'll be something before our foot hits the ground. Faith is saying, I'm going to put my confidence in God. Faith is saying, I'm going to go where God says go, even when it doesn't make sense. It makes no sense whatsoever for this man to go home. That makes no earthly sense whatsoever for this man to go home and expect to find anything other than a dead child. Let's face it. It makes no earthly sense for this man to expect to go home and to find anything but a dead son. But yet we read that when Jesus says, your son is healed, go your way, he went his way and he believed. It is a practiced faith. It is a faith. He didn't, listen, if you read that story, and again, I hope you've got a little bit of gospel sanctified imagination, that you can see this story playing out, and most of us shouldn't have much trouble imagining the majority of this story, because probably a lot of us have been there with a sick child. That you can picture this man, you know, rushing up to Christ and bursting through the crowd and grabbing him by the arm and saying, listen, you've got to come with me quick. You know, I'm not sure when we read the story, and you know, I know I didn't read it with the emotion that I'm sure, you know, that it deserved. I'm sure that this man, you know, he came running. You know, he probably, you know, a marathon's what, 26 miles? Capernaum's 22. He ran almost a marathon. I bet this man ran most of the distance. You know, and he came running up, and can you see him? He's sweaty, and he's tired, and he comes running up, and he's gasping for breath, and he grabs Jesus, and he says, Jesus, I got to talk to you. My son, my little boy, my baby, he's dying. Come on. And he begins to tug at his jacket and say, come on, these people can wait. Now they're all obviously, but my son, he's on his deathbed. Will you come with me? Come on. Come on. Come quick. I got my servants here. They'll put you on a donkey, whatever. Come quick. I'll carry you piggyback. Whatever it takes, come quick. And Jesus looks at him and says, your son is healed. Go your way. Oh. Okay. Think about that story for a moment. Let your imagination just see that scene for a moment. This father is obviously panicked. His child is on his deathbed. He's ran. You know, can you imagine, again, for you and I to say, I'm going to ask Jesus to heal my son. You know, if Archie tells Tabitha, we're going to pray for James, tells Kathy, we're going to pray for James, Kathy will probably go, yeah, that's a good idea. We're talking about a little different environment. We're talking about a little different timetable. When this man says to his wife, men, you've been there before when it comes to, you with me? When he says to his wife, honey, forget the doctor, I'm going to Cana to find this man Jesus I've heard about. Who? Jesus. Well, who is he? Well, you know, he's married, he's the carpenter's son. I don't mean to be too sarcastic here, but I can almost hear the wife saying, what do you need a carpenter's son for, to build our son a coffin? Jesus says, your son is well, go your way. Cool. Cool. A practiced faith. Is our faith a practiced faith? I've shared with you before, Tom Rainer and some of his studies found a church in Baltimore. It's an African-American church that every year you have to rejoin the church. And you're not automatically a member for life. You have to rejoin. Everybody has to rejoin every year. In fact, that's kind of a trend in strong churches, actually, that they go through their membership pretty thoroughly every year. You don't just get to sign up like you join in the country club. And one of the things you have to do is you have to sign off on the church covenant, saying, I live by the church covenant. And if they have any doubt whether or not you live by that church covenant, it says they do an investigation to the point of going and asking your kids, you know, interviewing your children. You know, does mommy do, does daddy? Yeah, think about that for a moment. A practiced faith. Do our coworkers, do our neighbors see a practiced faith in our life? Notice this, not only a practiced faith, but it becomes a proven faith. I have no idea what's on the screen. I don't know if that says prove. Where am I? I can't see it and I can't turn around. Is that it? That says proven faith. I think I forgot to push the button. A proven faith. I want you to notice something that is really cool in this story. And it was on his way home, his servants met him and said, your son lives. A proven faith. But I want you to notice something that happens here. This may blow your mind when you think about it. He inquired of them, when did my son start to get better? And they said to him, see that word? Yesterday, at the seventh hour. You might know when the seventh hour is? 1 o'clock. Yesterday, about 1 o'clock. And the father knows, he says, he is aware that that is the time when Jesus said unto him, thy son liveth. So let's put those pieces together. As he starts home, he meets the servants. And they come to him and they say, your son is living. Your son is good. He doesn't seem surprised in the least. He doesn't seem shocked. But he asked this question. Well, when did he start getting better? And he said, the servant said, yesterday at about 1 o'clock. Yesterday at 1 o'clock. And he knows that is when Christ said to him, your son lives. Stick with me here for a moment. So, at 1 o'clock, let's just say at 1 o'clock on Tuesday, Jesus said to this man, your son will live. Go your way. If at 1 o'clock on Tuesday, someone told you, you were told, your son who is at the point of death will live. What time do you think you would have been home? fast as you could get there. 22 miles. Roughly the average walking speed of a human being is roughly about 3 miles an hour. You got to think in this situation it's probably, as the military calls it, double time. And so with little if any effort, the father could have been home Tuesday. Now, I'm not saying it was Tuesday. I'm just using that for point of reference. The Bible doesn't say Tuesday. But if Christ told him Tuesday at 1 o'clock, your son will live, with little effort, he could have been home Tuesday night. Correct? Would you agree with that statement? Could you make it 22 miles in a day's time? Why didn't the man take off running and go straight home? Why? Because he believed. This man, he had a practiced faith that turned into a proven faith. I think it's important that when we read in this story that this man heads home and he sees the servants coming home, coming towards him. Let me ask you a question. When you left home, your son was on his deathbed. You've been to Cana, you start home. And as you start home, you see your servants coming towards you. Is that good news or bad news?
He believes.
Normally it's bad news. You see the servants coming towards you. I think it's important that when we look in this verse, we don't see, and the nobleman's heart skipped a beat. What we read is when Jesus says, "Go, your son is healed, go your way," he believed and he went his way. This man was so confident in what Christ had said that he didn't even run home to verify it. Remember, there wasn't no Facebook. There wasn't no email. There wasn't no cell phone. He didn't pull out his iPhone and say, "Mama, check on the boy. Jesus just said he was better." All we have are two words. He believed. That's all we got. Can I tell you something? That's all he had. He believed. This man's faith has moved from pursuing, not even exactly sure what, one meeting with Jesus Christ to the point where he believed. I want you to notice something about that story. It's one thing. It's one thing. And every parent in this room knows what I'm about to say is true. It's one thing to trust Jesus Christ for my healing. It's a whole nother animal to trust Jesus Christ for his healing or her healing. It's a whole different animal. It's a whole different animal. But he believed. A proven faith. A faith that hasn't been practiced and a faith that hasn't been proven isn't much faith. But can I show you one last thing? And again, several things, but several different people answered this question. And every one of them came to the same answer. Look what it says in this last verse. It says, "And so the father knew that it was at the same hour in which Jesus said unto him, 'Thy son healed,' and he himself believed, and his whole house." Why did his house believe? Well, his house wasn't there. They didn't go with him to Cana. They didn't make the trip. They stayed home and took care of the son. So how could they believe? He told them. He told them. When he got home, he goes from a pursuing faith, a persistent faith, a practiced faith, a proven faith, to a persuasive faith. Folks, can I tell you, that is the pinnacle of faith. That is the ultimate of our faith. When our faith arrives, when it develops, when it grows so much that our faith persuades someone else to follow. Have you ever taken a small child and said, come on, come with me? And they, no, I don't want to do that. What do you do? Taste this. This is good. Yeah. What do you have to do? You taste it yourself and show them. It's all right. You want them to step out on a bridge or something. What do? You step out on it. You show them, this bridge will hold me. Our faith, the ultimate sign of our faith is really not even what we believe or even who we believe in. But when our faith in what we believe in and who we believe in is so strong and so evident that others believe the same thing. That's faith. That's faith. Have you read some of the stories I've read? Have you read some of the news reports I've read? People taking and laying down on a bed and covering themselves up with a black sheet and laying a roll of quarters on their forehead to pay for their plane ride so when the space people come and got them, they could ride the spaceship. And that was how they were, you know, and so they drunk the poison and put the quarters on their forehead. I'm glad some of y'all wasn't in that crowd, because I know what some of y'all would have done. You'd have faked drinking the poison and you'd have gathered up the quarters. You read some of the stories I've read? People following Jim Jones, Guyana, and drinking the Kool-Aid? Have you read some of the... Y'all looking at me like I'm one of them Martians picking up the quarters. Have y'all read some of those stories? This is yes. You've read those stories? You know, I've wondered. I'm not the brightest light in the hall. I don't consider myself to be exceptionally gullible. But I've wondered just how it is these guys convince people to follow them spouting such hogwash. There's probably a better word for it than that, but yeah. How do you get? Yeah, I'd like to see somebody try to get me to pack up, and move to Guyana. I don't even know where that is. You couldn't get me to pack up, move to Gastonia, let alone Guyana. And yet, people somehow, these guys get people to follow them and have faith in them with such ridiculous, stupid, out of just beyond any reason stories. Shouldn't a child of God be able to convince somebody to follow Jesus? Shouldn't the Church of Jesus Christ, with the truth of the gospel, the way, the truth, and the life, shouldn't we be able to convince somebody to follow Jesus? Until our faith becomes a persuasive faith, Our faith, just quite simply, is not what it should be. Go through Scripture. You take and you go scan the pages. And you'll find over and over again that when people put their faith in Jesus Christ, they followed Him, but others followed them. Look at the disciples. Look at Andrew. Look at Pentecost. When we place our faith, our persistent, practiced, proven faith in Jesus Christ, it'll become persuasive. And others will want to follow it. I want to ask you to bow your head this morning. Our musicians are going to come. And our invitation this morning has several facets to it. Where are you in the development of your faith? Where are you in the growth of your faith? Let's start with a real simple question. Is your faith growing? Is it developing? Can others see that our faith is maturing? This morning you're here, and you'd say to me, Jimmy, I know there's no question in my mind. I know I'm a child of God. I know I've put my faith in Him, my trust in Him. I know that if I was to die today, I would go and spend eternity with Him. There's no doubt. Then the question I think we have to ask ourselves is, have we come to the point where our faith is persuasive? Can I suggest something to you this morning? Every person in this room, your faith is persuasive. You are persuading someone to follow Christ, or you are persuading someone to not follow Christ. I want to invite you in just a moment to come to this altar and kneel from all over this building and say, Lord, help me to have a persuasive faith. What we need in this day and age, what we need in this culture, is a persuasive faith. People who their life is persuading others to follow Christ. Is your faith persuasive this morning? On the very first note, don't even wait on the first note. Step out now. Kneel on this altar and say, Lord, help me. I want my faith to be persuasive. Persuasive to my family. Persuasive to my children. What a great testimony to be able to say my whole house believed. But this morning, you're here and you're kind of like this nobleman in the very first verse. You've heard about him. You know about him. You've read about him. But you don't really know him personally. You can't say boldly, confidently, I know that I am saved. I know that I have a relationship with him. Maybe you've been in church. Maybe you've been raised in church. Maybe you've held an office in the church. But the truth of the matter is, you don't know him personally. You've got a pursuing faith. You're interested. You want to see God. You want to see church. You want to see what goes on. You may be the deacon's kid, the preacher, the whatever. But you don't know him personally. You come this morning, let us show you from God's Word. It's time you move beyond pursuing. Jesus Christ is waiting for you. It's time to make things right with Him, to have a relationship with Him. As we stand together, we're going to sing. on the very first note, as soon as you stand up, step out, Lord, I want a persuasive faith. Lord, I got to put my faith in you as we sing together.